Good morning. So I'm going to talk about some work I've done that's originally motivated by interest in snow avalanches, to explain, you know, what are the physical processes that go on and what's the interest in them. So I'm going to start off by showing you a video of a very large experiment that all of you may have seen an avalanche. So this is in the west of Switzerland, and it was taken by the Swiss Federal Institute for Avalanche.
I don't mean to take up too much time, but is it possible to turn the lights on in the back?
Is that a pointer somewhere?
Yeah.
There's one explosion. It's just these explosive charges have been placed out of a helicopter on the final. One's just gone off there. Doesn't release anything. Another explosion that just goes off up on the right, and then all the snow underneath starts to move. It's held together in a slab by cohesion between the bonds, but it's not very stable. As it starts flowing, it's initially solid contact, the particles and blocks are rolling over each other. But as they accelerate,
you get... this
is real time. Yeah, this, it gets to about 150 miles an hour, this one. So as it comes down, a turbulent boundary layer forms on the upper surface. It mixes with the snow and it starts entraining it. So you start getting a dilute suspension current. This mast here is 15 metres high, which gives you some idea of the size of it. So overall, this has dropped about a vertical kilometre. And they've had considerably bigger avalanches. This isn't an especially big one. There used to be a 25 metre mast, pretty much at that location, that got destroyed in 1999, along with all the other measurement instruments and equipment they put there. This is one of the problems of this type of research, is A, getting your instruments in the right place at the right time, and B, making sure they don't get destroyed. So most of this work I'm going to talk about is done in collaboration with other people. So that's video was taken by the Swiss Federal Institute for Avalanche Research. I spent 4 years working in Japan, Koichi Nishimura, and a whole load of Japanese scientists. So some of the work will be from them, and also some Norwegian data I've worked with. So roughly what I'm going to start talking about is some different experiments on different scales. I'm going to start off talking about in sort of historical order of how I've worked on some of these problems. So I'll start off with some ping pong ball avalanches, which are quite a unique experiment. Not many people have been involved in that type of work. And I'll show that we took some measurements there and they can be applied to simple kinetic theories for granular matter. Then I'm going to look at some of the theoretical questions to do with the structure of gravity currents and how that fits in with this work. And talk about some little lab scale experiments to show that these ideas hold all the way from full size powder snow avalanches 1 or 2 meter shoot experiments, and then I'll finish off with the analysis of some of that data from that avalanche you just saw in the video. Finally, I'm going to talk about what are all the unsolved problems. So as far as current avalanche research goes, it's not really predictive at all. If you've studied an avalanche, you can create a model for it and you can fit a lot of parameters which do a good job of describing it, but as soon as you try to take those same parameters and apply them to another avalanche or try and actually measure them from the snow or something like this, they don't work. And this means essentially that the models, you know, they conserve mass and momentum, they're bound to be slightly right, but they're not really having the right physical parameters and the right physical mechanisms. And this is why they're not predictive. So as well as not being sure about these underlying mechanisms, you know, they are complicated flows. It's not that straightforward to simulate them. You've got three-dimensional terrain and structure. A big problem is that it's actually impossible. There's no good quantitative description of snow. What are the right numbers you need to describe snow grains? Fortunately, as far as powder snow clouds go, this isn't so much of a problem. Once the grains are suspended, these are very weak, these are very low suspensions, thank you, by volume concentration. So interactions between the grains aren't very important once they're in the powder cloud. And actually, you can describe them quite well with classical fluid theory in this regime. So the questions I was interested in, really, are how do powdered snow avalanches start? So you have this dense flow of granular matter, and it somehow mixes with the ambient fluid to become a suspension current. So this happens in the powder snow clouds. It can also happen in the desert. Sometimes you can get a sufficiently large sandstorm, and then this can actually flow along the surface as a gravity current. Also under the sea, you get turbidity currents. And this is where you have a landslide or a rock slide under the water, and it mixes up. And these can flow for very long distances over very shallow slopes. A particularly interesting one was when the French were constructing a new airport at Nice, and this was all on reclaimed land in 1979, I think. And one night, so they were shoveling all this mud, basically, into the sea to build it up. And one night, the whole thing disappeared. And they were a bit embarrassed about this, but they weren't quite sure what had happened. And it turned out that some cables under the sea had been broken more than 100 kilometres away by this turbidity current. So they knew how fast it went and how far it went by where it broke the cable. And they also found these huge bits of earth-moving machinery which had been carried along in the current. And initially it was quite a steep angle, but over most of the bed it's running along a slope of 1 or 2 degrees and it's carrying these huge bits of machinery. And no one can really explain these things. So there's this, how do they start? How are these suspensions brought up? Then there's the question of how do they spread out laterally? There are no theories that can describe this at the moment. People have tried, but I'm going to show you there's some obvious flaws with this and they're wrong. Now very often with these type of models, you don't want to solve for the full three-dimensional structure of the flow, so you do shallow water approximation. This means you average over one of your directions. And these seem to be extremely successful, even though they make some very strong assumptions. And what I can show is that these, in some ways these assumptions can be relaxed, and that's why they work so well, even though the assumptions they're normally based on are wrong. And then, of course, whenever you're developing theories and ideas, you really want to do some experiments to make sure that they're actually correct and you're focusing on the right mechanisms. So this is the question, is what are the best measurements to take to validate the theories? So these ping pong ball experiments happened on the normal ski jump hill of the 1972 Olympics, 150 metres long. We had up to 550,000 ping pong balls, which is about 8 cubic metres. One of the reasons they wanted to do the experiments on this scale is so that they could test the sensors that they'd actually deploy in a real snow avalanche. So you can test the real sensors, but in a much more repeatable way, and check that you really understand the measurements you're getting. So the main thing that determines the scale for this experiment is the free fall velocity of these balls in air and how quickly they reach this free fall velocity. So in general, if you have a flow over a slope where the velocity of the flow is large compared to the free fall velocity, you can expect strong interactions with the ambient fluid. And if this distance is large compared to this relaxation distance, then you can expect quasi-dynamical steady states. So I'll start off by showing you a video of 10,000 balls. And this is a whole series of cameras along the side of the slope, and then from the bottom looking up. So it starts off like a dam break. The balls kind of bunch up in the head a bit. There's extra drag on the front from the air, and the balls behind can move up. And it creates a small head at the front. Down at the bottom, we've got a whole load of sensors, including some people. They don't react much to 10,000 balls, but they move a bit more with the faster one.
The bottom ground restitution is zero?
Yeah. The base is made up of bristles. It's used by skiers all year round. So it's very slippery. So ordinary ping pong balls. So they have reasonably high restitution off each other, but they're not off the base because it's these bristles. 25 grams, yeah. We did have some We did some other experiments with practice ping pong balls which are larger than orange, so that they go slow, and then you can look at segregation. We're not going to talk about that today. So with 350,000 balls, it's roughly the same type of thing. They all flow out, at this point mostly individually. And as the flow speeds up, they start to bunch up into the head. This is characteristic of gravity current type flows. You can see a high head and some of these balls are saltating out the back of it. This blue line has been put on by some image analysis software for testing these things. And you can see this guy there pretty much falls over and then rolls down the slope. The type of, you only want to stand in the way of those once. The fastest ball is about 20 metres a second, which leaves bruises. So one of the experiments we did is we had these video cameras very, very close to the surface, and then we get pictures like this. And from the size of the balls, you can calculate their three-dimensional position. And as far as I know, this is one of the first experiments where people actually looked at the 3D position of balls in a granular flow and tracked them. Now, the tough job, as anyone who's ever tried these sort of experiments knows, is correlating them between one frame and another. These are conventional video cameras, so it's quite a slow frame rate, so balls move a long way. Fortunately, we had some dedicated graduate students who had the fine job of looking through some of these pictures and matching up the balls in between. So we've got 3D velocity and position data for these flows. Now, having said that we got this data, there's obviously an awful lot of sample bias with this type of procedure. And we didn't manage to do it for that. The statistics are quite low. You know, you're only getting a few hundred or perhaps a thousand data points. This shows just one way you can look at some of the data. We've got time along this axis and height here. So this corresponds to a ball gaining height a little bit between two frames. And you can see the overall shape of the flow here corresponds well with this. There's no data in this region because you just can't see into it from these things. This is the main thing. You've got a head, which is about 10 centimetres here. This is not the same as this picture, this data, by the way. This was a smaller avalanche, going up to about 40 centimetres. And then you've got the main body, about half the height of the head, and these odd little saltating balls on the top. Now, obviously, conventional fluid mechanics, you have a no-slip boundary condition on the base, and generally your velocity profiles are monotonically increasing from the base. With these flows, it's exactly the opposite. Here we've got ball speed on this axis, and the velocity decreases as you go up in height. So that's one of the nice things about granular flows in some ways. They're actually simpler in some senses than conventional fluids, because you don't need to have a slip boundary condition. You can have a no-slip boundary condition. They can slip along the bottom, and this is an approximation you often want to make when you're looking at high Reynolds number flows. So this is fairly well satisfied for these. And then the velocities decrease as you go up. And the reason they decrease is because it's mixing with the ambient fluid, the air in this case, and it has to accelerate it. So the main drag is coming from the top. The bottom surface is only important in the very final stage of the flow when it's coming to rest, when it's sedimented down. And we can match up velocities and position very well down the front with a zero friction coefficient on the base, just looking at the interaction with the air. And this is one of the first results of this work, because it's been controversial in people studying powder snow avalanches. A lot of people thought, you know, the main effect was due to the base and a turbulent hydraulic type friction. And this shows quite good evidence that this is not the case.
Well,
yeah, well, they're rolling. No, you can't say that. There's a lot of differences between these experiments and real snow avalanches, but the basic I'll talk a bit more about boundaries later, but basically in any type of gravity cone, in a powder snow cone, it's very, very high Reynolds number, so you'd expect a thin boundary layer at the bottom, but the main decelerating effect is actually entrainment of the ambient fluid. These flows have reached kind of a steady state, which is another nice thing that you can get with granular suspension currents, where the entrainment of the ambient fluid is matched by the sedimentation out of the particles.
Would you remind me, what is free fall velocity
Well, actually rolling down the slope, an individual ball only goes at about 2 meters a second. But as you put more and more of them together, yeah, they scale. So, but I'll talk about the scaling now then. You basically, if you don't, it's a high Reynolds number flow, so there's no viscosity involved. So the only real scales you've got are the density ratio between the balls and the air. The number of balls, which gives you a length scale, and gravity. And this means that the velocities have to scale as the sixth power of the size of the object. And this is just a simple scaling for anything falling in the air. There's no other parameters that come into it at high Reynolds number. And that's what we see, that these flows do scale very well with the sixth power of the number of balls.
The solar velocity at the top is a result of the loss of momentum to the air.
Yeah.
Is that the only dominant reason?
Yeah. So, I think you all probably know about kinetic theory. So, the basic idea was we've got these velocity things. We wanted to try and see, you know, do they give stresses which, in some way, accord with kinetic theory. A particular thing was most versions of it, people assume isotropic velocity fluctuation tensor. This is probably very good away from boundaries and for high restitution coefficients. But when you're close to the boundary and the restitution coefficient is far from one, it can be extremely anisotropic, and I'll show you data to support that. So this is the kinetic theory stress tensor. So this is the square root of the diagonal elements of the temperature. So we have velocity fluctuations along this axis, and this is different points along the flow. So blue, this is the velocity fluctuation in the x direction, so this is down the slope. And you can see this is very large in the head and about the same as the vertical, the z-direction velocity fluctuations. And you need to have these large z-velocity fluctuations to support the height of the head. This is giving you a pressure in that direction, which is why the head's high. When you drop back in the flow, these are lower, where the flow is smaller. But they're still considerably large Z fluctuations though, so the balls are still bouncing up and down off each other. Remember, they can't bounce off the base because it's got zero restitution, but they can bounce off other balls which are in contact with the base. The interesting thing is that the lateral velocity fluctuations, which would drive spreading, are doing a very poor job. They're much, much lower. They're 2.5 times lower than the vertical ones. So in no sense is the pressure hydrostatic. If you wanted to look at the lateral spreading, it wouldn't be correct to take the hydrostatic head, which is in balance with the x fluctuation. And this
is the top. There's only for the ones you visualize.
Yes. Yeah. So you can't get, you know, there's a lot of sampling errors in this type of procedure. You know, you certainly don't measure this for all the balls by any means. So it's not conclusive. Perhaps if you looked at everything, this would turn out to be wrong, but I think it fits in with what we've seen. It's quite plausible. And so that was just the diagonal element. You can also look at what are the angles to rotate the principal axis, or look at the off-diagonal elements. And essentially, this is slightly hard to interpret in fact, but really the principal axes are rotated at 45 degrees. But that's not so well defined because in the front, the vertical and downslope directions, the velocity fluctuations are pretty much the same. The main idea is you've got one plane with large fluctuations and crosswise much, much lower fluctuations. And further back, it's much more isotropic. Now, as I said, the main interactions, the main things dominating these flows are the interactions with the air. So one of the other things we wanted to look at was the airflow in front of these avalanches and behind. This is also a good thing to try to measure with snow avalanches, because you can get quite a lot of information from the airflow in front of the avalanche before it arrives. So even if your sensors are destroyed or malfunction when the avalanche arrives, you can still hope to get some data. So the way they did this is they had these downward pointing tubes, and they were designed like this so they wouldn't fill up with snow when they're deployed in the field. And you can adjust for the airflow around these tubes to get some relation between the pressure in the airflow and its velocity and what output you should get. The main idea, though, and the model I'm going to talk about first, is that any object moving through air, if you're far from the object, you can expand the velocity field is a multipole expansion. It's high Reynolds number, the flow has to be irrotational. You don't have to worry about vorticity in front of the object, regardless of what's happening beforehand. Apart from the object, you know the velocity field has to be of this form. Where essentially you've got two parameters. You've got the velocity of the object and its effective aerodynamic radius. And this result is, of course, exact for a sphere, at least in the front region. But any object will behave like this, far from it. You can calculate what the pressure should be in front of the object as it approaches. So if you fit this curve, you can back out the size and the speed. So that's what we did. This shows you one of the results. It's blue, it's a signal, after we've made some adjustments to account for the centre response. And then this is the dipole type fit. So in this case, it suggests an effective aerodynamic radius of about 1 metre. That's more than the height, and then the flow is wider than that, so it's somewhere in between that and a velocity of about 10 metres. Its maximum pressure, this corresponds to a front stagnation type point, except what I'll tell you later, this isn't actually a stagnation point. But this is the point of maximum pressure when the avalanche arrives, and then you have a very large pressure drop. Yeah. But it has to be potential. No, it can't be turbulent in front where it's compressing. Really, the only way it could be not in front of the flow. The only way you could get turbulent flow in front is in a narrow boundary layer near the ground where the air is being pushed along there and it could trigger. But generally in front of any object you that's moving, you'll get a good approximation to irrotational flow. At some point, as you get behind the object, it will separate off and become turbulent, but not in front. So this is just some of the data. You don't, from picking some of those, I talked about the scaling earlier. The length scale has to go as the cube root of the number of balls. The velocity is related essentially to the Froude number type condition. So this goes to the square root of the length scale, so the sixth power. This scaling works very well for the maximum velocities and also for this air pressure data. The key thing is, these velocities we get from the air pressure are much lower than the actual front velocity. So that means that the air is actually penetrating into the front of these flows. And this is not some... Sorry?
You're considering the air front as an object.
Yeah.
And air breathing is effective radius.
Not. This is effective radius of the length scale that comes in the dipole expansion. So it's the radius of a sphere that would have the same effect on the air in front of it. Roughly, it's not quite the same as the cube root. It's a bit more complicated than just the volume of the object. It does depend on its shape.
Presumably, it's a long, slender object. It's, you can do a 2D potential flow expansion also for the same.
Not really, because it's not. I mean, far from the object, you a 2D expansion won't fit. If you're very close into, very close to the head, and I'll talk about some 2D analysis of the flow field later. So that's a good question. But the main thing is that there's a very large penetration velocity. There's a big slip velocity, and this is of course not something you get with classical fluids. You only, even in two-phase modelling, you normally just have one mean velocity field. But here you need to have two because they can penetrate over considerable distances. So this is the point of arrival of this avalanche, and then you've got this big drop. So if you have penetration between the two flow fields, there's a force between them, a drag force on the balls, and of course this corresponds to work being done against the fluid, so its pressure will drop, so you get some drag. Now if you consider a static matrix of particles with some pressure distribution around them, the pressure at any point inside is a solution of Laplace's equation over the boundary, so it's effectively an average. So you can't get any pressures inside that are lower than pressures on the boundary. And for most simple type of shapes, like spheres and stuff, even though you have regions of negative pressure on the boundary, the pressure inside always has to remain positive. So this doesn't hold for all shapes. The question is, this slip might explain part of this pressure decrease, but you'd never expect it to give you extremely low pressures. But if you at least assume that the first part of this, so the initial drop in the pressure, this gradient is related to this slip and the drag done by the air, you can then back out the effective density. If you take the drag law, you can take the drag law just knowing what the parameters are in terms of the terminal velocity for the individual balls. So using this time scale and this pressure drop, this was the speed of the flow for one of the experiments, 15 meters a second, whereas the airflow is only 8 meters a second. So it's only moving at half the speed, and so it's really penetrating hard. And this is also partly why the balls are blowing off the top, because the air is actually moving right through part of the front and taking the balls out. And this suggests that the volume concentration should be about 0.2. And it's not that easy to measure it accurately from the video measurements, but it's compatible. It's compatible with that.
Do you expect this effect to be penetration to be as large or as small?
No. This will scale is with the particle size. So this is something which you wouldn't get. You wouldn't get if you scale up. This is an effect because, you know, the flow is quite small in terms of particle number. So if you wanted to, for any type of these flows, you'd perhaps want to consider a band. It would be a boundary layer effect, essentially, as you scale the flow up. But in these flows, it's important. You know, the front's all in the boundary layer, as it were. So you can try to, because of the symmetries of the problem, it's effectively moving in a plane. The curvature of the slope's quite low, and you hope it's symmetrical across the slope. You can consider a streamline that goes down the centre of the flow on the boundary. And even if it separates, you can still apply a Bernoulli-type equation all the way along the bottom and calculate the granular stresses. Now, you know, we're having to average these velocity fluctuations over quite large regions where the mean velocity is varying in some way, so you're not going to get, you know, an exact quantitative balance. But what we wanted to see is, were these quantities the same order of magnitude? So there's various terms. These are calculated just for one experiment. So this is a kind of a pressure term from the kinetic theory. This is about twice the overall pressure drop across it. This is a term related to the drag, the work done by the drag of the airflow on the particles. And this is the driving acceleration. What we can see is that they are all the same order of magnitude. So all these effects are important in the dynamics of the head. You won't get it right unless you include the slip and the granular pressures and the overall effect of the airflow. So this is in the head. Further back in the body, the velocity fluctuations are lower and there's no interpenetration, essentially. The air is now moving along with the balls, and the main retarding effect is just this mixing on the upper boundary. So just to show, those were pressure measurements in the ping pong ball flows. This is one from a real snow avalanche. This is much more complicated. So there are certain effects in front of the flow. You're expecting to be Reynolds number independent for sufficiently high Reynolds number. As far as the turbulent structure goes inside, this will depend on the Reynolds number, and you get a much more complicated thing, an extremely high Reynolds number, natural avalanche. This is from a direct numerical simulation at a much lower Reynolds number. This rise in front is not an exact dipole fit because the simulation was done in a finite volume. You can use symmetry methods, so you effectively have a whole grid of dipoles to calculate exactly what the dipole fit should be in front of the flow, even for finite volume, and this does agree with that. But again, you have this large negative drop, and this is a perfect fluid calculation, so none of this is due to interpenetration. So they had a whole load of this data in Japan of these pressure drops, but they weren't quite sure how to explain it, what these negative pressures were due to. So that was one of the motivations for my next piece of work. This is just talking about the overall picture we had for these flows, with the air penetrating some distance into the front, coming out at the back, it separates. You've got a low pressure region and a high pressure at the front, and some transition in between. And this is what I was saying about how you if you want to calculate the pressure of the point in between, if you assume, for sake of argument, static motion, you just get an integral of the Green's function over the boundary. And this means...
Sir, is this low pressure lower than what we get in the weight in our single particle?
Yes, because in this low pressure here isn't. This is exactly the same. The low pressures in the here are very negative compared to even the stagnation pressure at the front. Normally, when it separates, you get zero pressure drop, or you don't get pressure change across the separation. You'd expect this to be reasonably close to the background pressure in this region, whereas we get some very very low relative pressures here. So the question is to look. One of the questions was is, you know, why does the pressure drop dramatically along here? So this is a schematic of a gravity current moving from right to left. I'm going to take gravity in any direction, so the gravity could be vertically down or this way. I don't want the analysis depends very little on that, but we've got a denser fluid. We're going to work in the rest frame where this supposed stagnation point at the front isn't moving. And we want to consider the high Reynolds number limit. So our boundary conditions of normal velocity is zero along the base and along this interface. The pressure is continuous everywhere, but the tangential velocity doesn't have to be continuous across boundaries. And you could put boundary layers in if you wanted to fix this up. And this is really revisiting some early analysis by von Karman and Benjamin, who looked at this problem. And they said this angle has to be 60 degrees if there's no motion inside the gravity current, and in the case when gravity is vertical. And by equating the hydrostatic pressure and connecting up streamlines in Bernoulli's theorem, they said that the food number has to be square root 2. So I wanted to extend this to motions inside the front and arbitrary slope angles. So what I do is a expansion about the separation points. I'm just going to consider a general stream function so it can have vorticity. And what I'm going to talk about here is the first order approximation. So you assume some power of the radius multiplied by some angle of theta, and you can take higher terms if you want to. And we're considering the steady case, so we get an Euler equation for this function f. The nice thing is you can integrate this and you end up with an implicit equation for what this stream function, this is h to the power of f, has to be in terms of the theta. And for general alpha, you can't do this integral, but you can do it in some cases, and you can do asymptotic approximations in most of the other. The most interesting one, and the one that I'm going to show is the only one that matches up, is this one where alpha is 3 over 2.
What is alpha again?
Alpha is the power of the power of R in the expansion of the stream function about the stagnation point. And then you get an exact solution in terms of inverse elliptic functions.
There's no singularity,
but the function, you have to have a non-analytic function.
Yeah.
So you could assume, so, you know, it's an exponent, it doesn't have dimension. There's a problem, of course, with this, is, you know, why you're taking R over alpha, there should be, this isn't dimensionally consistent to have a length scale to this. This comes about because there's no length scale in the original problem. If you put in some length scale, it corresponds to, what's the word? You can do renormalization groups for some of these singular problems, and this is the type of effect you get. But that's not really important for the time being.
Alpha should be related to the angle, right?
Yes. Yeah. There's a relation between alpha and the angle, determined by that equation. So
it gives you a point at which there's a branch cut.
So the stream function has to be constant along. So to actually match up, there's a relation. So for example, in the irrotational case, the stream function is called alpha theta. So that if it's going to be constant along the streamline, you've got to have alpha theta. Alpha theta is pi over 2 or whatever.
So it's a location of the branch cut in the potential flow solution in context.
Yes, that's what this boundary is going to be.
So the analysis is saying that alpha has to be 3/2.
Okay, no, I haven't shown you why it has to be that yet. So far, you can have any type of solutions, and this matches up the pressure. So this matches up, you know, the velocity. These are the solutions where the normal velocity vanishes on the boundary and solves the Euler equation, but we haven't matched up the pressure along the boundary. So even though you can't solve in general for the, you only get this implicit relation in terms of an integral, you can calculate what the velocity and the pressure is exactly on the boundaries, which is what you need to perform the matching. But one of the surprising things is that the pressure doesn't depend on the angle at all, except through the hydrostatic term. And in both sectors of the flow, it's just a radial function. Then if you match up this for the both bits along the boundary, outside of the flow, because it has to be irrotational, you get to get the linear term, you've got to have this 2 alpha minus 2 equaling 1, and this is why the alpha has to be 3/2. There's no other way you can match up the pressures. So this is for any angle of G, it doesn't matter whether the slopes from anything from vertical to horizontal, and it doesn't matter how large the internal velocities are either. All that matters is this expansion around the point, which has to be valid. So you should always get this 60-degree angle, even with. And this shows a little experiment with some polystyrene balls moving down a slope. This line is drawn at 60 degrees. This is the actual direction of gravity. So this slope's actually 70 degrees. So this front's completely overhanging, but it's still at 60. This shows that this idea is correct, and it's nicer to do with granular particles in suspension, because you don't have the boundary layers much slower. To get classical fluids, the bound and laboratory scale experiments, your Reynolds number is rather low, so you actually tend to get quite a significant boundary layer on the bottom, and the whole node rises up. It's not so clear about the front angle in that case. So you have this type of model of the current. At least in the front, there's some vortex of arbitrary strength. That's the problem with this theory. It doesn't predict where this vorticity comes from. This has to come at the top, presumably, and then be advected back into the flow. At the rear, you have some separation. And then the rest of what's happening in the back of the flow, this will be Reynolds number dependent. So you could have a whole series of vortices or a very chaotic turbulent structure. In the low Reynolds numbers experiments, you tend to just get a single coherent vortex. The other problem is dealing with what's going to happen at the rear stagnation point where the background flow is separated. This really ought to be flat. But the point is, you can draw a streamline, again, along the surface, and it doesn't really matter what happens in the rest of the flow. You can still, even if it comes off, you can still apply Bernoulli's theorem along here, because the normal velocity has to vanish. So you can match up the pressures here and here, and so you can still get that the fluid number has to be root 2, as long as you define the height in this fashion. You have to be careful if it's a completely flat current to make sure that when you're defining the height to get this to work, you're looking at this region at the back. Whereas when it's on a slope, you have to be careful to ignore the viscous tail. So in this region, gravity, you typically get a very thin tail that corresponds to the individual balls and the ping pong balls. Or with the fluid, you often get a thin tail of the fluid left behind on the slope. And this is a viscous low Reynolds number regime, and this is the height that determines the fluid number condition. So we measured the pressures for some of these experiments as well. So I told you before, in the front, you should have this dipole type pressure field, and now we've got this theory of how the pressure should vary inside. If you assume you have a single elliptic type vortex, then you're basically just going to get a linear pressure behavior. So you can predict all the way through. And this shows one of the experiments. So the gray line is the data. Then if you'd assume a hydrostatic, i.e. no significant motions inside, you'd have to just have this line here, which is obviously a very poor fit. So with this theory, you get an extremely nice fit in this case. As we said, it's only really justified in this front region. The front region of the flow. It's more complicated to do things in the back. Now that's for suspended current. If it's a dense flow, then you've got the particles rolling over each other in contact, then essentially you expect the pressure inside to be this average over the front surface and likely to be much more positive. And that's what you see. So you can distinguish the suspension currents from the dense flows by the signature of the air pressure measurements. And this is reasonably repeatable. This is a whole series of experiments superimposed. It has to be said, this fit in the previous graph was one of the nicest ones to fit. You always get this type of behavior in the front and the back. The behavior in the tail is much more variable. So I don't want you to think that that's completely typical, that lovely fit I've shown you before. The conclusions of this result are that you can extend these results of von Karman and Benjamin to arbitrary internal motions, at least near the stagnation point and any slope. And you always get the root through food number. And it explains these large negative pressures. What's nice is it also explains why the shallow water equations are so effective, because you have to put in a food number condition on the boundary of these things. And with the shallow water equations, you're neglecting the vertical velocities. You're saying they don't influence the pressure at all. But what I've shown is that even if they do influence it and it's significant, you still get the same food number condition, so you could still expect that the shallow water equations would work well. And there's one other thing that's nice about fixing this front angle at 60 degrees. When you do a shallow water type model, you have to pick a direction to average in, and essentially people do it in two ways. You can average perpendicular to the slope, which gives you an implicit model of this form, or you can average vertically in the direction of gravity, which gives you an implicit model of this form. Both of these will fail for either flat slopes or vertical slopes. The relationship between their height and their volume is singular. And if you have a 60 degree angle, you always get a finite volume for any slope. So you can get this predicts different scalings through this dependence of the volume on the height, since the food number condition depends just on this height. This predicts different scalings of what the velocity should be, depending on the volume of particles you're doing. There aren't any experiments yet to test whether this scaling is correct, for reasons which I'll explain. Now, that was a two-dimensional analysis. Of course, these flows are not two-dimensional, even when the fronts are fairly flat. You might think, well, how can I extend this to three dimensions? And the problem is you can't. It doesn't appear that there's any steady states. Now, the reason for that is the pressure has to drop linearly along the front surface to balance the excess buoyancy. And the flows have to be symmetric in some sense. And if they're going to drop linearly along the slope, then that pressure is going to drop off too fast. So the flows will always come round. There was only one of these type of solutions I found which corresponds to this stream function for the external flow. And this corresponds to a vertically falling cone of material which would have a front angle of 65 degrees. And this can then be the shape can then be in hydrodynamic balance. It would be interesting to see if people could actually see this with an experiment. But what that means is for a general three-dimensional gravity current, the flow will always be opening out at the front. It will always be trying to become flatter. And that's something that's seen. They do try to become flatter, and then once you have a flat front, they become unstable to Loeb and Cleft type singularities and in bent. So
this is only a two-dimensional expression, though.
That was an axis symmetric.
3D analysis, but axis symmetric.
Well, okay, you can do the 3D analysis. That's the only solution I found was an axis symmetric one. You can do the 3D analysis, and it's not. I haven't done it. Managed to do it completely rigorously. Yeah.
So, I'm sorry.
This is a Legendre, this is a Legendre polynomial, and this theta is the angle from the axis. So this is
from the axis of motion, from the direction of.
Yeah.
And by axisymmetric, you mean it's basically a cylinder.
What you've got is a cone.
Oh.
You've got a cone type solution. So this is your ambient. So you have to rotate about this axis. So you've got, it corresponds to the external flow around the cone, and then this gives you this linear pressure drop in all directions. Otherwise, the other sorts of things you can try is, so looking at the 2D cross section, you have the current like this, like I showed before, and then you can, now looking from above, if you try to look for a non-singular solution like this, you can try to do a local solution. But there don't seem to be any. So what it means is the pressure will always be too low in the ambient, so this will always flatten out, tend to become flat.
And then you said it would be damped.
Yeah, this is what we see from experiments. There's no theory. So if you have a flat gravity current or something moving, and with these particle ones, they just tends to become unstable, and you get loads and cleft before. So your instabilities develop, and then they disappear, and then more develop, and so on.
I mean, in your movie, it looked as if there were sort of steps developing on the sides or something like that.
On which?
This blue line that was drawn in the picture, I mean, that seemed to sort of be flat in the middle and then have some steps.
The front definitely doesn't dent. I mean, I can show you some more of those movies from the small experiments as well. But yeah, they tend to flatten out and then become unstable. Is that?
So, but if you have a wide front,
yeah,
that's a situation where you think the 2D analysis would be adequate.
Well, if the fronts are typically, they are smooth in this direction, so over any vertical distance is small compared to this, its expansion should be good. It should be like locally, like in this vicinity, it should be like a 2D flow.
Right.
Over. I mean, you.
So that you need the 3D analysis mainly to go front and back.
Yes, that was this is part of the problem. If you actually want to try to connect this solution properly to the external flow, which I glossed over, you really need to get some length scales into your local solution here. And you can do that in 2D. You can get 2D solutions which do it. But it doesn't seem like there are any steady 3D solutions. Okay, I'm running out of time a lot here. But so we wanted to look at this transition and look at these steady states. One of the interesting things is with the granular flows, because the particles can re-sediment out, they can balance this entrainment on the upper surface. The classical fluid experiments are often done with plumes, so you have a dense fluid moving down a slope or moving vertically, and what you see, the entrainment velocity of the ambient air is proportional to the velocity of the flow at that point. It comes from simple dimensional analysis and works very well. So these plumes will always entrain indefinitely. But with these flows, they'll sediment back out and start to become stationary or steady state, perhaps, in some sense. Now, to get what determines the rate of this entrainment is the Richardson number, and this is a ratio of how much turbulent kinetic energy is available to entrain particles compared to the potential energy they gain by being entrained. So, if you have a very high Richardson number, you get no entrainment; it's completely stable. Have a zero Richardson number, you get the fastest entrainment. There's no potential energy needed for a vertically falling plume. The particles can move horizontally easily, so it's a purely kinematic type effect, at least for low density differences. And this is another interesting thing, is that most of the work's been done where the difference between the plume or the gravity current, the density difference, is very small compared to the background. So this density difference only comes in a gravitational driving term. There's no difference in inertia. So this is what's known as a Boussinesq approximation. Whereas for powder snow experiments and any type of suspension current in air, pretty much, the gravity the density difference is very large. So if you only have 1% of snow by volume, it's still going to be twice the density of the ambient fluid. So this extra momentum of the particles is very important. And this makes the entrainment non-symmetric. So we did some experiments in Switzerland with snow. We dropped it down a funnel into a sieve. This is because the snow sinks together into large blocks and you need to fluidize it. Then it would flow down the slope. This is where the air pressure sensor was. I showed you some data from before. We've got a side view. And we go right up to 90 degree angles to get a zero Richardson number where we hope for indefinite entrainment. And we did experiments in Cambridge with a standard box type release of polystyrene balls. These are all of order a couple of meters. And you might think standard polystyrene are very different materials, and of course they are in lots of ways. The key thing is really the length scale over which the particles reach their terminal velocity and what this terminal velocity is. And these are pretty similar to both sets of particles, so the experiments are reasonably comparable. So let me show you 100 milliliter polystyrene one from the side. This is 32 degrees, fairly dense flow, and then we step up the angle, 45 degrees. The discrete nature is still quite clear with these small 100 milliliter ones, a lot of particles bouncing around. Especially as it gets to the steep angle, it's just breaking off completely. At the top, that's 91 degrees, total freefall. Why would people do it at that angle? Well, it's not quite the same when you have much larger. So this is 8 litres, this is 80 times larger. So at 30 degrees, still pretty much a dense flow.
That's the total volume?
Yeah.
How big is the particles?
A couple of millimetres. So this is 159 degrees. Believe me, there's no line drawn in, but that is about 60 degrees. We've got this big head developed. This is a reasonably low volume concentration here. And as it gets steeper, it entrains more and more. So this is over vertical. And you saw before, the individual balls, they just dropped straight down. But this is still anchored. Some of these balls are dropping. These are being partly dragged up by the gate, giving them some velocity in this direction. But it's anchored to the slope. The nose has completely lifted off, though. And probably if this was left long enough, it would separate from the flow. But it's still pretty much on there, even though this is above vertical. And it's even swept back a bit from this. It's because there's a lot of drag experience on the upper surface from entraining the air and accelerating that, whereas there isn't at the face. How exactly these noses lift up is a very interesting question for classical fluids as well. It isn't well understood. You can look at them from the top as well, to look at the lateral spreading. And what you see is what you'd expect, really. As it gets steeper and steeper, if it's vertical, there's no longer any hydrostatic pressures to spread it out horizontally. You just expect it to be an entrainment phenomenon. And then this is the largest one. So we did a whole range of experiments inside in between. So on the shallow slopes, it spreads out very quickly, quite a straight edge at the back. But this spreading is probably viscous dominated with drag on the bottom surface. As it gets steeper, first of all, it looks like a lot fewer particles, even though it's the same, but that's just because they're all coming out towards you. But it's much more like just a kind of a jet. And the only lack of spreading is due to entrainment.
Now, these fronts and so on, they look qualitatively the same as what, say, David Morey sees at MIT using silica beads or whatever it is, sand in the water. Are you aware of these?
I haven't seen I'm not aware of his work, but I'd be interested to see it. But it should be the same it should be very similar in water.
Because you're going from air to water and the densities are higher.
Well, the one of the reasons for doing it in air is you can get very high density differences. it's hard, you can't get such high differences in water, but there should, a lot of the things should be the same. You know, there's slight difference in the parameter energy access, but I'd be interested in seeing his work. It should be very similar. But certainly, one of the things about these experiments, when I first did them, no one had ever done any currents. It really started off as a dense flow and became suspended. And I thought this would be easier to do, easier to work in air. And it worked. People had tried to do dense to suspension current experiments in water, but they never got it to work. I guess the Reynolds numbers were too low in what they could access. So what you can see, for example, with the height of these flows is it increases with the slope angle as you'd expect, but then for the very steep slope angles there's a big jump, it's not continuous. And this is because once it gets really steep, then the sedimentation stops being able to balance and reduce the entrainment, so there's a switch in regime. Really, you'd expect this to be at 90 degrees, this change, but with this data it seems to happen a little bit sooner. And that's probably related to the lateral spreading. But there is this shift in behaviour. I think the only other thing I'll talk about now is just the velocity. What you might have expected is, you know, as these slopes get steeper and steeper, the flows go faster and faster. But in fact, they don't at all. They stay, the velocity stays pretty much the same, regardless of the slope angle. And that's because the extra entrainment reduces the overall density of these flows. There's two effects. They've had to do all the work to accelerate the air up to speed, and then they've also decreased their density to drag ratio. You know, it's a much lower volume flow than larger front area. And this seems to balance out extremely closely. This is quite important if you want to, you know, understand what the speed of Patterson avalanche is going to be on different slopes and how it's going to vary. And I think I'm pretty much out of time there. So developed some theories to describe these flows. The problem with all theories that involve turbulent entrainment is there are coefficients which can't be calculated. You can non-dimensionalize things, and you typically need an entrainment coefficient, and this has to depend in some way on the Richardson number. And this is essentially something you have to measure and put into your theory to fit. But we also have the problem with these experiments that you've got the lateral spreading, and this complicates things a lot. And it's very hard to put the lateral spreading properly into a theory because, as I said, it depends on how the ambient pressure flow spreads out around us and the pressure decreases. And you can't solve for this over the whole side of the flow in an approximate point-like manner. You need to solve the whole elliptic model. So there you can know what the pressure flow is far from the flow. You need to know what it is on the surface. So you need to have some analytically good approximation to the shape of the flow and be able to solve for the airflow over that, and at that point you can start to put in the lateral spreading. And that seems to be the biggest hurdle for developing analytic theories for these flows. And it means it's not straightforward to do numerical calculations either. You don't want to have to calculate the whole exterior flow field, but it might be possible to couple an interior model for the actual gravity current itself with a boundary element method for calculating the external flow. And that would probably be the best way to do a simulation to reproduce this data. Okay, I'll stop that. Well, okay. So I wasn't using potential approximation, but I was using a stream function, so I was allowing vorticity, but not. So that it doesn't work on. It won't work on the scales where the part of the particles, but if it's on a larger scale flow, it's averaged out, it's definitely going to be a good approximation. But this certainly is a problem. If enough, in a sense, it's a power series about the stationary point, so it has to be valid there. But it's just a question of how tiny this region is where it's valid. I mean, if it's so small compared to the flow, it's not going to hold. And certainly, you know, you'd expect, when you look at the much larger Reynolds number things, you do get these huge loads and stuff at the front, and it's going to be more complicated. But in the lower Reynolds number experiments, at least with these particles, it does seem to explain this angle quite well. So I'd say it seems to be a lot more effective than it could be. You can't justify it all the way up like this, and there's no reason why it should work, but it does seem to work very well. Any more questions?
Yes, please.